Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why doing away with taxes on tips may lead to more workers asking for them.
And reinterpreting Shakespeare in the borderlands.
But first, Arizona doesn't have enough housing, by about 270,000 units, in fact. That's keeping costs for new home buyers and making it harder for young people to get into the housing market at all. But it turns out a big chunk of the houses that young families might want to buy, those with three bedrooms or more, are owned by baby boomers whose family size has shrunk down to one or two people, usually. There might have been a time when most of those empty nesters would have downsized, but not today. And here to tell us why and what it means for the Valley's housing market overall is Mark Stapp, director of ASU's Real Estate Program, and Fred E. Taylor, professor of real estate there. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Okay, so I've read about a quarter of these kind of family-sized homes, these three bedrooms plus houses, are owned by baby boomers in Phoenix today. That's a big change, it sounds like, from what we used to see.
Yeah, well, I mean, the baby boomer generation is a large percentage of our population in general, and about 79% of the baby boomer generation owns their own home. And so that's not surprising to me, and they were buying homes and occupying them at a time period when we were increasingly buying and in building larger homes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the quote-unquote silver tsunami is one of the things that is talked about in the housing industry. Is it a wave that's going to roll over the housing industry and all of a sudden all of these big homes are going to become available? Mm-hmm. And the answer is probably not. It's going to happen over the next two decades, actually.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be more spread out than it may have been otherwise.
Yeah, it's going to be more spread out. I mean, the population that constitutes the baby boomer generation occurred over more than a decade.
Yeah.
And so we're not all going to get old at exactly the same time and make the same decision to sell our homes.
Right. Why aren't people downsizing as much as they used to or selling off those homes in general?
I think there's a couple reasons for it in the current environment. One is only about 30% of the baby boomers, people over the age of 65 that own a home, have a mortgage, mm-hmm. right? So you don't have a mortgage. You don't have to make payments on your house. And those who do have a mortgage, they're more likely to have mortgages that are low interest rate bearing. And so from just a pure economic standpoint, financial standpoint, leaving their house is more expensive.
Right.
Plus the whole idea of aging in place. They're comfortable there. They like it there. And for some of them, it's a generational thing. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is going to happen is a lot of wealth is going to be transferred to the baby boomers' children.
Right.
And a lot of that wealth is wrapped up in the houses themselves. And so I think people are staying in them longer. They've got that wealth. They also don't want to sell them and realize some of the capital gains that they may have to pay on them. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a number of reasons that keep people in the house and keep them off the market itself.
Okay, so let's talk about the impact that has then on the housing market more broadly, because we have a supply and demand problem, right? Like, we don't have enough housing. If people are holding onto their homes longer for all of these very reasonable economic reasons, right, what does that mean for the housing market in general?
This is a problem we've had. You know, we've talked about on the show before, mm-hmm. is we simply had such a significant slowdown during the Great Recession, and we're never able to build ourselves back up to equilibrium. And I think a higher percentage of the inventory has to be added by new building. And new building has been under a lot of pressure because of cost constraints, higher interest rates that have kept people, I would call it actionable demand, from actually being able to buy homes. Mm-hmm. Although those factors have kept inventory very tight. The you know, the concern that we're going to dump all these houses on the market by seniors, we're probably going to see somewhere in the order of magnitude of maybe 950 homes a month. So we sell existing homes about, on average, somewhere around 6,000 homes a month are sold.
Okay.
And if only 950 of those are part of that equation, mm-hmm. it's not a tsunami
okay.
at all.
So it's going to be slow enough it won't have that kind of major impact.
I don't think so. There's an interesting study done by a researcher out of USC in conjunction with a researcher from Fannie Mae looking at what they call cohort retention rates.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how many people in a particular age group as they move through their life remain homeowners. And that retention rate's very, very high until you get past the age of 75.
Okay.
And then it drops off precipitously for, you know, a bunch of obvious reasons.
Right.
You just typically can't stay in the house anymore. You need care. You die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the house gets now converted and it's either bequeathed or the family decides to sell it. And sometimes they decide to keep it and rent it.
Yeah, yeah. So lots of implications there. It's also part of a bigger trend, though, we're seeing in general, right, Mark? And just not with boomers, but in general, that people are holding onto their homes, not selling. Does this have to do with interest rates?
Oh, absolutely has to do with interest rates. You know, there was such a large percentage of people that got low interest rates from 2015 on that it didn't make any economic sense to sell the house and then have to mortgage a new one at much, much, much higher rates. So you're buying a house at a higher price and you have higher mortgage payments. And it's really constrained the marketplace.
Yeah.
So the hope is the Fed begins to lower rates. But I don't think that when if the Fed lowers rates in September, it's probably about a quarter of a point. I don't think that that's going to roll swiftly through the marketplace. You know, this got a lagging effect. I think some of it's already built into to rates.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a step in the right direction. It's going to take probably bringing mortgage rates down closer to 5.5% before we're going to see a big movement.
All right. So a little bit of time to wait there. All right. ASU's Mark Stapp joining us. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
In speaking to Democrats gathered in Chicago last week at the DNC, former President Barack Obama had a request.
And then there's Donald Trump. Don't boo. Vote.
The line urging people not to boo, but rather to vote, is one he's used often over the years. And it got our next guest thinking about the best ways to get people to do things differently than the way they're doing them. Liz Lerman is a choreographer and professor at ASU and joins me now to talk more about this. Liz, good morning.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Nice to talk to you. So one of the things that you wrote on social media after hearing this was, give people alternatives and amazing things can happen. So how do we go about giving people alternatives?
Well, it's a great question. And also, how do we get people prepared to receive the alternatives or to feel that they're empowered to actually follow through? But specifically beginning with the idea that when you tell people, no, don't do something, people still don't know what to do. I liken it to when my daughter was two, you know, and you would say, don't touch the stove.
Yeah.
But she still doesn't know what to do with her hands. So you have to say, well, put your hands over here or put them over here and make it a game. And then suddenly we're into something. So it's partly I was really moved when I heard him say that no isn't enough. Giving people something to do is fantastic. And actually at the same convention, right, they started saying, Michelle Obama kept saying, do something. And everybody said, that's good. Do something is good. But some people need more than that. That is to say, it's too big an area. They need, you know, more specificity in order to know what to do.
I think
we need to do both.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking of, in preparing for this interview, two taglines that I wonder if you maybe think could have been more effective in terms of Nancy Reagan's Just Say No and Nike's Just Do It. Like, those seem like they're kind of big things that maybe people don't quite know what to do with.
Yes, they sort of come around at the same time. The just say no is really not enough, because people caught up in whatever the obsessions are around that need help, guide, you know. And in that case, and this is where I kind of wish we had more opportunity to practice what we in the arts call, you know, collaborating, mm-hmm. Getting help from people. It's interesting. I'm co-teaching with somebody here, and they do DIY technology, and so they've done incredible stuff on their own, figuring things out. Me, I need to get help, and I ask for help, and then I get help solving my technology problems. Those are two different approaches. They're both good. They're both interesting. The just do it is interesting too. I mean, do you think it helps? You got that in your ear and you say, get up, you can do it, you can do it. It has a little bit more of an encouraging factor to it.
Yeah.
I think people need encouragement. And I don't think it's like you need it once. I think you kind of need it every day. Come on, you can do it. You can do it. It's a beautiful thing, you know, and you watch marathons and things like that, and people are all along the side say, come on, keep going, keep going. So it's not even just getting started, it's being able to sustain it.
Right. Well, so I wonder how this sort of plays itself out in the work that you do. Like, I can imagine, you know, you are in a on stage, you know, with a number of dancers, and you're practicing the choreography that you've put together, and somebody is maybe putting, you know, not quite doing it correctly. And yes, you need to tell them what to do it correctly. But isn't it also helpful if they know what they're not doing correctly, so they know not to do it?
Well, it kind of depends, right? And some of that depends on the nature of harm. Look, if you keep doing it like that, your knees are going to give out, mm-hmm. right? So let's not do it like that. So some of it's that way. Some of it is actually back to me, Mark. I mean, I would ask myself, does it matter? Does this person actually have to do it this way? Mm. Is that person telling me something I don't know and doing it in a more interesting way? And should I take that in? And that's one of these questions that I have about the idea of improvisation, which I know a lot of people, again, think just lives in the world of the arts, but I don't think so. I think our lives are fully improvisatory. And that part of the question you and I are talking about today is, when do we give ourselves very tight systems by which we're going to work? And when do we open that out and experiment a little bit? And I think we need both. But you're right. Sometimes you just have to say to somebody, no, don't put your hand like that. Put it, you know, do it like this. You do have to say no.
Right.
And actually, in the world of consent, we want to understand how to say no, because we need to.
So I want to bring it back. We have about a minute or so left, back to sort of where we started in the world of politics. And it would seem to me that there's a very easy solution to this, right? Vote for me, or vote for this person that you want someone to vote for. Do you find that there's a lot of that going on, or is there mostly, is it mostly like affirmative, like do this, vote for me, vote for this person, or don't vote for that person, don't do what this person is saying?
Well, personally, I mean, for me, I'd rather sort of see it lay out a set of goals and sort of values and a kind of way of life, and that you're giving people ways to fill their imaginations so they can imagine what would it be like to have this particular thing happen, and then have that help them to make decisions. And back to that means giving people agency. So I go back to my 2-year-old daughter, right? Don't do that, don't do that. Or tell her, put your hands here, let's experiment. She is building and practicing agency for taking action in the world based on her own imagination. And of course, that's what I'm interested in.
Right, that is very interesting. Okay, that is Liz Lerman, choreographer and professor at ASU. Liz, it's always really nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Lovely to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a reimagination of Shakespeare plays through a Borderlands perspective.
All of the playwrights in this collection are really drawing from a long tradition that, you know, takes into account their cultures, their histories, their lived experiences, right? And really, it's using Shakespeare as a vehicle to discuss the social issues that are important to them.
How an anthology showcases the bard in a different light. But first,
the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on a controversial Arizona voting law last week, partially granting an emergency stay that will limit Arizonans' ability to register to vote without proof of citizenship. The decision had the Republican National Committee claiming a critical win to halt non-citizen voting. The state party called it a monumental victory for election integrity. But our next guest calls it a paperwork shift. Lori Roberts is a columnist for the Arizona Republic, and she joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Good morning, Lori. Good morning, Elvia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so Lori, this was a complicated case. It started when state lawmakers tried to pass this law kind of tightening voter requirements. It was challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court. Now we have this partial and temporary, I should say, decision that essentially means that those registering to vote without proof of citizenship will only be able to do it using a federal registration form as opposed to the state form. So in your reading of this, like, what are the real world implications of this decision, Lori?
Well, I don't really think that there are a lot of implications to this decision. The Republicans are claiming this huge victory for voter integrity, but the only thing that it does is require that people in the future who don't have documentary proof of citizenship handy can register to vote. They just can no longer use the state form. They have to instead use the federal form. But they still will be able to vote in presidential and congressional elections as federal law allows. So in essence, it doesn't really do anything. I mean, the law was passed in 2022, and the Republicans had hoped to knock off tens of thousands of voters, what we call federal-only voters, off the voter rolls, contending that if they haven't provided proof of citizenship, they must then be here illegally. Or I guess that's their thinking. A vote beat analysis has shown that most of those people are actually grouped around college campuses in Flagstaff, Tempe, and Tucson, which makes me presume that that's really not a hotbed of illegal immigrants who are registering, but they're probably college students from out of state who just can't get their hands on, didn't bring their birth certificates to Arizona when they came here. And the Supreme Court met them, I would say, not even halfway, maybe a third of the way, and decided, well, yes, Arizona, you can refuse to allow them to register to vote on your state form, but they can still vote.
Right.
So really, not a whole lot changes.
Right. So they can't vote in local races. They can vote for members of Congress, Senate, the presidential race, the things, you know, the big
Correct.
Ticket items.
But they already could only vote in federal races. They already were barred from voting in state and local elections as a result of a 2004 law that was enacted by voters to require documented proof of citizenship in order to vote. And I would like to point out that we are the only state in the United States that requires documentary proof of citizenship. So people keep sort of referring to this as something shady going in Arizona. In fact, we have tougher requirements to register to vote than any other state in the union.
So, right, like, this seems kind of obvious on its face, Elvia. Like it seems like, of course, you can't vote if you are not a U.S. citizen. That's already a crime. And as Lori pointed out, like, there's a vote beat analysis that shows that most of these federal-only voters who didn't have proof of citizenship when they registered to vote are focused around college campuses. What do you think this is about, Elvia?
Well, I mean, it's about undermining the election and undermining confidence in the vote, you know, not only in Arizona, but across the nation, right? I mean, just like Lori explained, this really doesn't change a lot. You know, it's already the law, yet they're claiming victory. That kind of rhetoric goes everywhere, right? And it sort of feeds into this idea that undocumented immigrants, people not here legally, are voting and taking advantage of the system. I mean, look at what at the federal level they're trying to do by essentially saying that hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants are crossing the border, you know, with the idea of just voting. That's ridiculous. But, you know, that they know that. They know this. I mean, the Republicans pushing for this kind of stuff are not fools. They're pretty smart. They know what they're doing. And so it just to, you know, to get people into thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, people are voting illegally. That's what it means from my point of view.
Yeah, let me also point out here that if you are a federal-only voter and you register to vote, the state law still requires the county recorders, the county elections officials, to go through the state voter rolls and check them against various databases, Department of Homeland Security, et cetera. So if they find out that you are a federal-only voter and you really aren't eligible to vote, they're going to be coming after you, and it's a crime. And if you are here illegally, you will be deported and barred from ever coming back. So it kind of begs the question of, would someone really cross the border here hoping to become part of this country and then say, oh, I think I'll go vote, knowing that if I'm caught, I'm going to be deported and can't ever come back?
Mm. So a lot of voting rights advocates who have fought against this have said it's like fear mongering, like you're kind of pointing out, Elvia. But also after this decision late last week, many election officials are saying that there's another layer of concern here, just that this could create confusion for voters really close to a very major election. Are you worried about that, Elvia?
Well, yes. And I mean, just look at the headlines claiming a huge victory when there wasn't really one, right? I mean, and the headlines, depending on what outlet you are reading. And I think this is why the Supreme Court decided to do this. You know, it's a temporary thing. They're not looking at the merits of the appeal, right? They will do that later. It is too close and people do get confused. And, you know, obviously a lot of people are in the process of registering to vote. And it is, I mean, I must say it is a little bit confusing to have two forms, but it's pretty easy once you get to it, right? I mean, do you have proof of citizenship? Yes or no. And so which form are you going to be able to use? But on the other hand, it also gives us the opportunity to talk about this, right? To really explain, you know, why there are two forms to register to vote. It gives us an opportunity to talk about it, but who's talking about it is also important here.
Hmm. Lori, let me end with you in a question about the broader implications here. Like, this case may not make much of a difference heading into November from what you're saying, but how it ends up could have major implications for how voter registration laws work in other states eventually, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, at the end of this case, if they decide to throw out the National Voter Registration Act, which I think was passed 30 or 40 years ago, certainly that will change a lot. Every state then will move to documented proof of citizenship, as will the federal government. But I will note that when the legislature first tried to do this in 2004, the case did ultimately go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court favored the National Voter Registration Act. They came down and said that was legal, that it would be illegal to require documented proof of citizenship because, of course, so many people, or at least enough people, would be disenfranchised because they can't provide that proof.
All right, we will leave it there for now. Lori Roberts, columnist with the Arizona Republic, joining editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning. Lori, Elvia, thank you so much, both of you, for coming on. I really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This summer, former President Trump said he supports getting rid of taxes on the tips that workers earn. Trump made his announcement in June in Nevada, which has the highest concentration of tipped workers in the country. Shortly after that, Vice President Kamala Harris said she, too, wants to eliminate taxes on tips. And while neither candidate has put forward detailed plans on provisions like how they would do that and who exactly would be eligible, having both major party candidates support the idea has led to a lot of conversation about it. Our next guest is not in favor of the plan. Adam Chatterow is a professor of law at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. He joins me to talk about this. And Adam, why don't you think this is a good idea?
Yeah, it's bad both from a theory perspective and from a policy perspective. So let me start with the theory, right?
Sure.
The income tax should be imposed on all income, which includes wages and salary. And tips are a form of wages and salary. So it doesn't make sort of theoretical sense to say, okay, we're going to tax you on the part you get from your employer, but the part that your employer essentially doesn't pay, but it comes from the customers, that's income, but we're not going to tax that. So that's the theoretical problem with the idea. The policy problem is that it creates huge inefficiency and distorts the economy and will lead to sort of dynamic changes in game playing that you can try to stop, but then that's going to significantly complicate the code.
So I want to ask you about the game playing, because you write about this in the sense that you're almost, in your mind, incentivizing people to not take jobs that don't involve tips because your entire income would be taxed, as opposed to a job where part of your income would be taxed, but tips, another part, would not be.
Right. So the example you might use is somebody's trying to think about, should I become a bartender or should I become a public school teacher? And let's just pretend for theory's sake that they both make $40,000 a year, but the bartender gets $10,000 in tips and the teacher doesn't. So if you're thinking about it from an economic perspective, you would much rather be a bartender than a teacher. We've created an incentive for people to pick bartending over teaching. And that's not to say that bartending isn't a noble thing. And we need bartenders. And there's nothing like a well-made cocktail, let me tell you. But we don't want the tax system to force people one direction or the other, right? The whole idea, and it's actually a Republican idea, is that the market should determine what people do and let them follow their preferences. But if you tip the scale one way or the other through the tax system, you're going to get people going one way or the other, even if they'd rather go the other way.
That seems like a very sort of theoretical argument. But like in the real world, we know, for example, like a college professor and a bartender probably don't make the same amount of money. So are you really disincentivizing somebody, let's say, from going to, you know, get an MBA or something who's going to, you know, be an executive at a company versus somebody who's going to work in a more service-oriented job? Or are you just concerned about the types of jobs where the salaries are closer to what a tipped worker might earn?
Right. I mean, it depends on what you're motivated by. But if you're motivated by, you know, what's my after-tax return, right? How much do I get to keep when the day is done? Somebody who's going to go into business or you know, earn $100,000 a year probably isn't going to say, yes, but some portion of my much lower bartender income is tax-free. We're not going to lose people to bartending from high-income jobs. But anybody who's earning about the same amount, if they're acting rationally and economically rationally, is going to pick the job where less of the income is taxed.
Is there a way, and both former President Trump and Vice President Harris have talked about the idea of wanting to allow tipped workers to keep more of their income, right? Not have to pay it in taxes. Is there a way to let that happen? Because I would think that would be a good outcome from a societal standpoint to some degree, as long as you can make up for the lost revenue in the government. But if workers are able to keep more of their money, they're probably going to spend more of it. That creates more sales tax, more jobs for people, that kind of thing.
Right. So if your question is, like, should we help people who are low income folks, right, who need help, who are struggling in the economy? The answer to that is almost certainly yes, because there are all kinds of follow-on economic effects like you just mentioned. The question really is, what's the best way to do that? And the best way to do that is an across-the-board, neutrally applicable rule, like, for instance, lowering taxes on everyone. It isn't picking winners and losers. And that's the problem with this proposal, is that we are essentially saying to the world, tipped workers are more worthy in some way than other people who make the same amount, who have the same economic struggles they do. But we're going to give a tax break to these people and not to those.
I'm curious how you see this proposal in the context of what I think most of us, or at least many of us, have experienced in terms of more and more places asking customers, would you like to add a tip?
Right. So during the pandemic, right, we saw this shift in tipping culture, and most folks are really frustrated by it. This would supercharge that problem. Because now, all right, I'm not going to ask my employer for a higher wage. What I'm going to do is try to extract more tips out of my customers because I keep more of that. And so that's a problem. But the other problem is right now, right, there are certain people we tend to tip, right? Culturally, we tip these people and not those people. Well, if suddenly tips are not subject to tax, right, I can imagine my doctor or my accountant or my lawyer saying to me, look, I'll charge you half of what I normally charge if you'll consider a tip. And so what we will see is this pressure, this dynamic response, this pressure for people we don't normally tip to start asking for tips. And I don't think we want to go there.
In addition to sort of the awkwardness of, you know, a physician, you know, filling out your chart and saying, okay, by the way, you know, they hand you a little screen and say, what kind of tip would you like to add? Are there other sort of economic issues with that or policy issues with having more types of services that are soliciting tips?
Well, if we allow tips, right, to go untaxed, then there are huge problems with it. Because what we're basically saying is, depending on the kind of business you're in and whether you're customer facing or not, we're going to give you this fabulous tax break. And so what we're going to end up doing is having tips start sort of spreading and expanding, and that's going to be problematic. And we're going to lose a lot more revenue than we think we are.
If we are going to keep the status quo where taxes are paid on tips, what does that mean for employers or states in which employers are allowed to pay their employees less, assuming that they are made up? The difference is made up by tips. For example, states that are allowed, where tip workers are allowed to be paid less than minimum wage, with the assumption that they will be brought up and maybe even beyond that by the tips they earn.
Right. Well, so there's been pressure in a lot of states and also at the federal level to do away with this reduced minimum wage for tipped workers. If we allow tips to go tax-free, any pressure to raise that minimum wage, I think, will disappear because the workers will say, we don't want more minimum wage because that's going to get taxed.
Yeah.
We want to figure out how to get more tips.
All right. That is Adam Chatero, professor of law at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Adam, good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Great to talk to you, too.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The World Health Organization has declared the rapid spread of a new strain of Mpox in parts of Africa a global emergency. And that's led some people to wonder whether we're facing another global pandemic similar to COVID. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. And Pete, tell us about this new strain. Is it more dangerous or infectious? And should we be worried about this becoming another global pandemic?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say here, Mark, is that global pandemics, COVID, it's fresh in the minds of many, isn't it? It doesn't seem that long ago that many of us were, you know, having to work from home, or there were lockdowns, or, you know, masks had to be worn. So to answer your question, the shortest answer basically is whether this is going to be a new global pandemic or not. Probably not. And I'm going to quote Dr. Hans Kluge. He's the World Health Organization Regional Director for Europe. And he said last week, Mpox, quote, is not the new COVID. The risk to the general population is low. However, I believe that people are worried about this because, well, first of all, as you mentioned in your question there, the World Health Organization did declare a global health emergency on the 14th of August after a new variant of Mpox, which used to be known as monkeypox, was spreading rapidly through the Democratic Republic and across into 12 other neighboring African countries. And then last week, what happened was cases began to appear for the first time outside of Africa. And that has piqued the interest of people in the West, wondering if it's going to spread. Now, essentially, as I said, Dr. Hans Kluge there of the World Health Organization reckons that Mpox is not the new COVID. But what I would say is that what is key to this is vaccines. However, having said that, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, it is a serious situation. Getting vaccines into the places that it's needed, such as the DRC, that has proven problematic, partly apparently to do with red tape put up by the World Health Organization, but also due to costs as well. However, we're hearing that vaccines, 10,000 doses, will be going to the DRC this week. So hopefully that should slow things down.
Sure. All right. So, Pete, from one global health story to another, this time, though, in your neck of the woods in the UK, there's a debate raging over whether a new drug that slows down the effects of early stage Alzheimer's disease should be provided by the National Health Service there. So what is this drug and how significant a breakthrough could this be in the treatment of Alzheimer's?
Yeah, I think it's important to say here, Mark, that I wouldn't normally bring a British or UK or English health story and an argument between, you know, a health body and the government on who should pay a drug to your audience over there. However, this is about Alzheimer's, and it's about a what Alzheimer's researchers or Alzheimer's scientists have described as a significant breakthrough in the treatment of Alzheimer's. And I think it's a disease that is increasingly affecting and touching more and more of us. So the drug itself is called lecanemab. And the reason that Alzheimer's researchers and scientists have got excited about this is it's the first drug that's been proven to slow the progression of early stage Alzheimer's. However, on the other side of that, in extensive trials, there were frequent occurrences of small brain bleeds and temporary swelling on the brain. Now, the researchers involved in those trials say that most of those cases were mild or without symptoms, but in some cases that required hospital treatment. So there is a concern over the possible side effects. The other thing to say about this is it's expensive. There's no price in the UK, but I can tell you that it has been costed up in the US, and they reckon it's about $26,000 per patient per year.
Wow.
Now, it's been approved, this drug. It's not cheap, is it? You know, it's been approved in the US, Japan, and China, but it's not been approved by the European Medicines Agency, the EMA. They rejected a license last month, partly because of the worries over the possible side effects, but also because of the cost of the drug. So the thing to say here in the UK is there is a debate now on whether the government should pay to supply that drug. It seems as though the advisory body here would say no. However, on a global stage, this is an exciting drug. Scientists say it could help with early stage Alzheimer's. But one other thing just to say about that, the problem there is that early stage Alzheimer's and the symptoms of early stage Alzheimer's are often very difficult to detect. And I suppose drug companies might argue, or, you know, governments that are going to supply this drug, what is the cost of giving someone, you know, it's not a panacea, it's not a cure for Alzheimer's, it will only slow the early stages down. So maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's an extra year, maybe it's 18 months that it will slow things down. And I suppose there's the debate between, you know, how much that is worth. And I guess some would say it's priceless if you got another 6 months, a year, or 18 months with your mom, your dad, your grandparents, something like that.
Sure. All right, Pete. Finally, the Paralympics opening ceremony will be taking place on Wednesday evening, of course, in Paris. So what can we expect? Like, are there going to be boats of athletes floating down the River Seine in a way similar to last month's Olympic opening ceremony?
I wish, Mark, I could say that there were. I thought that was bonkers in a good way. I thought it was brilliantly bonkers that the opening ceremony of the Olympics this year, you know, for the first time, took it outside of the stadium and put it onto that famous river in the French capital. It won't be on the Seine, but it will be on the Champs-Élysées. So they're still going to be doing something outside of the stadium, just not floating boats down the river. Another thing to say on this one, it'll be the biggest Paralympics staged so far. 4,000 athletes competing in more than 500 events across 22 different sports. So there's lots to look out for. One thing that I found interesting just reading into this over the weekend, the Olympic rings. I did not know, maybe this is my own ignorance, but I did not know that the Olympic rings, those five Olympic rings, are not also the official symbol of the Paralympics. And I just read at the end of last week that the Olympic Committee has now allowed Paralympic athletes that have the Olympic rings tattooed onto their body, they're now going to allow them to display that for the first time. Because in previous years, if you're a Paralympian and you were off to represent your country and you decided to tattoo the Olympic rings onto your body, you were going to have to cover them up. But now the IOC has said, no, we don't mind anymore. You can display that. So look out for that when we're watching the Paralympics, which begin on Wednesday.
All right. That is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. Pete, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Shakespeare is perennial in our culture. His work's relevance never really goes away, and once in a while, it pops up in a new way that seems all the more relevant. That may be the case for a new volume published by the Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies at ASU called The Bard in the Borderlands. It's a collection of Shakespearean adaptations reflecting the culture and history of this region of the world, both critiquing and celebrating the bard in the process. This is the second volume they've published, and I spoke more about it with Center Director and ASU English Professor Ruben Espinosa.
As you can imagine, Shakespeare has been part of teaching and cultural institutions for a long time. And so it's in the United States, it's not a surprise that he made his way into particular communities and communities of color, right? Yeah. And so this genealogy is very long. In terms of the Chicanx community in particular, I think a lot of it was influenced by Teatro Campesino, and mm-hmm. they would often use some Shakespeare in these plays from, you know, that took place within spaces for migrant farm workers, right? And it was plays meant for resistance and to think about, you know, correcting social inequities in particular moments. And what we often find Shakespeare in these communities and others of marginalized people is that it's used as a tool of resistance. So you would expect Shakespeare to offer certain perspectives, right, that uphold particular racial hierarchies, mm-hmm. particular, you know, views of gendered hierarchies, right? But the plays themselves often challenge these hierarchies. And so some of these playwrights capitalize on that. And all of the playwrights in this collection are really drawing from a long tradition that, you know, takes into account their cultures, their histories, their lived experiences, right? And really it's using Shakespeare as a vehicle to discuss the social issues that are important to them. Because let's be honest, it's he carries quite a bit of social capital.
Absolutely. That's such an interesting kind of contrast. So this is the second volume of this particular anthology. You're choosing particular works each time. This time you have The Merchant of Venice, Measure for Measure, The Comedy of Errors, The Winter's Tale. I'm familiar with some of these to a certain extent, but it does seem like there is a common theme here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I should say the editors of the anthology, Catherine Vomero Santos, Catherine Gillen, and Adriana Santos, all professors in the San Antonio area. So it's going to be a total of 14 plays. The first volume had 6 plays, and those 6 plays focus on probably 2 of the most famous of Shakespeare's plays, Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet. So
yes.
In some ways, adaptations of those, you might be more familiar. This set is focusing on comedies or tragicomedies. So it's, you know, looking at a different genre and different ways of imagining the human experience. So where you would have the tragedies looking at a kind of negative view of the human experience, right? Comedies are supposed to end on notes that are uplifting, right, that show promise, hope for a future. But as you can imagine, even the tragic comedy type of label, right, gestures at how these plays also engage with, you know, really important topics like racial hierarchies, like racism, anti-Semitism, right? And so these playwrights are tapping into some of this to, on the one hand, truly think about just futures, right, for their own communities, but also to navigate, you know, the complexities of the lived experiences in the current moment, right, when they're writing, and also when these plays are set within each particular piece.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about what this actually looks like and sounds like. Yeah. Like, when these playwrights have adapted these, give us an example of, you know, where you might see The Merchant of Venice or Measure for Measure take place in an anthology like this.
Yeah. So one of the plays in Volume 2 is The Merchant of Santa Fe by Ramon Flores and Lynn Knight. And in this play, they're imagining this place set in colonial New Mexico and really looking at a tradition of kind of crypto-Judaism in the area. And they're also imagining the force of the Spanish domination, right, and colonialism. But speaking about the legacy of that to our present moment and thinking about those particular struggles, the difficulty of negotiating identity, the aspiration toward whiteness, Europeanness in that period, but also, you know, in the current moment. And, you know, I can't think of something, all 4 plays actually in this second volume, I think, speak meaningfully to our present moment.
So that's interesting. So just because they are set in the Borderlands doesn't mean it's set in present day. Are any of these set in more present day?
You do, yeah. You have some that are set in present day. Lydia Garcia and Bill Rauch is probably the best example. It's La Comedia of Errors, based on The Comedy of Errors. In Shakespeare's play, right, there are these 2 brothers who were separated at birth, and they ultimately find each other. You know, it's kind of a long story, convoluted story.
As Shakespeare is.
That's right. That's right. I will be the first to admit that. But, you know, they adapted this and thought about the brothers being separated at birth, and one is very much considered a legitimate U.S. citizen, right? And the other is not. And so it presses very hard on that issue, and it has, you know, even Border Patrol agents become part of the narrative.
That's fascinating. So, okay, so Shakespeare is so much about language, as you know, obviously. Talk about the adaptation there. Like, does this sound like Shakespeare? It's multilingual. Are we writing in iambic pentameter? Like,
so that's a great question. These plays do not. These adaptations are very much owning the language, setting it, you know, in particular moments, right? But not necessarily adhering to Shakespeare's language nor elevated speech. And so in some ways it's accessible. The one I mentioned, La Commedia of Errors, that one is bilingual, and I mean truly bilingual. There's quite a bit of Spanish in there. So if you don't speak Spanish, there are large moments in that play where you might feel a little bit lost. But I mean, I think, you know, this is something I love about these adaptations is there's not a reverence for the bard, right? There is not, it's not seen as a, you know, this kind of sacrosanct entity. It is really interrogating that, because let's be honest, I think most people who attend a Shakespeare play the first time are probably lost for the better part of the play themselves.
in English or Spanish, right? So that's absolutely true. That makes a lot of sense. So that brings me to a question I wanted to ask, which is about sort of the, I guess, the goal here, but in a more nuanced way. Like, is this a critique of Shakespeare? Is this a celebration of him and sort of the infinite adaptability of his work? Is it both?
Yeah, I think it doesn't have to be an either or dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there is room for both. So it very much leans into that. And in its own way, celebrating Shakespeare by using Shakespeare. But let's be honest, I think a lot of playwrights often will take on Shakespeare because they know that it will sell. It's something that will be staged. And so there is that element to it. But there's also then, how do you engage with it? How do you critique Shakespeare, right? And I think by and large, every playwright is giving Shakespeare some side eye, but also celebrating it, you know, concurrently, and really drawing on the energies of what the plays afford. And this is why I love it. I mean, my own research and, you know, work on Shakespeare, I have focused my life on Shakespeare. Yeah. I'm the president of the Shakespeare Association of America. I mean, this is as geeky as it gets. But there is, in my own studying of Shakespeare, I mean, I do recognize that, you know, there is ample room for criticism. The way he's been used as a tool of colonialism, the way his plays have, you know, kind of nascent forms of racist language, right? The establishment of racial hierarchies, the privileging of whiteness. And so it's important to say, look, these plays are great and there's so much of it, but look at this particular moment, right, where there is, you know, racist language to establish beauty. So I often think about Juliet and Romeo and Juliet. You know, there's a moment where when Romeo first sees her, in fact, he describes her as a rich jewel on an Ethiop's ear. And the idea is establishing something beautiful and light against blackness. And then he goes on to say, like a white dove among a troop of black crows. Those are the moments that we don't stop to think about. Like, what is this doing in that period? How is it imagining beauty, right, along the lines of fairness? And more importantly, I think, how are contemporary audiences then reading that? What does a student think when he or she or they might be looking at this particular play, right, and they are not white, and this kind of notion of beauty is established? So in their own ways, I think these playwrights, based on the communities from which they are drawing, the cultures and the histories, and how Latinxes have been imagined or not imagined in the way that we imagine the United States, are interrogating some of those issues, some more explicitly, some more implicitly.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. Ruben Espinosa, ASU professor of English, a Shakespearean, and director of the Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies at ASU, the press that published this book. Thank you so much, Ruben, for coming on. I really appreciate you being here and talking about this.
Thanks for having me.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.